Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule. And for today's episode, we are diving deep into the watery world of Ned Irving, artist, voiceover artist, and a man who's completely obsessed with life under and on top of the water. His work has emerged from a lifelong fascination with light, movement, and perception. He was born on Ibiza and has been shaped by its ever-shifting reflections. He sees the world as a living composition, a continuous dialogue between surface and depth, stillness and motion. And we're here to have a little get-together, basically, and check out some of his work at the Olas Gallery, Santalaria's newest and most prolifically beautiful artistic gallery. If you are passing, it's very close to the Passion Cafe, overlooking the sea. It's got a little sea view, and it's very gorgeous and is always displaying the incredible work of some of the island's most amazing artists and photographers. And actually, I'm standing here with one of them. Ned, welcome to the Reset Rebel.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
I feel a bit shy touching the microphone around a man like you.
You really? Oh, is that because of my voice? Does that intimidate you somehow?
It does, actually. I started to get a little bead on there just while I was reading the introduction.
I put a little cream on the voice there for you just to, you know. I'm a voice actor, so, and people do sometimes tell me, they say, do you do this on purpose? Do you speak like this on purpose? I say, no, this is my voice, and that's why people hire me, actually, to speak and work for them as a voice actor.
I mean, you didn't sound quite like that a minute ago when we were having a cup of coffee together.
I'm because I'm a...
You do have a radio voice, just like I do, and it's a thing.
But the thing is, it happens automatically. If you stick a microphone in front of me, I'm gonna smooth it up a little bit.
I was going to say, you've turned into the man from the Cadbury's advert. Right. But better and smoother.
Thank you. Chocolatier.
And where did this voice come from? I mean, obviously, it's got a bit of a mishmash. It's not very Ibizenco, shall we say, for a man that grew up here.
My parents, my mother was Swiss, my father was from New York, and they met here on the island in the 60s. And the interesting thing is, as a kid, we spoke English at home all the time. And as a kid, I imitated people on the radio and on television in Spanish, and then also in the United States, I mean, speaking with my father, and I would invent commercials in my head, just walking around, pretending to be a radio announcer or someone on television. And I never really intended to be a voiceover artist. I studied music, and at the age of about 27, I realized I was going to be poor for the rest of my life as a musician, and I was speaking to my father, and he said, "Son, you have a God-given gift, that's your voice. Do something with it." And it just went click. And then I started applying for jobs as a voice actor, and things just took off right away, and decided to do that instead of music.
I can hear why, Ned. It's quite clear to me that is your human instrument, and you must play it more often.
And it's easier than schlepping a set of drums around, because I was a professional drummer. And you can imagine playing in clubs and bars and carrying all that equipment, and then 2 or 3 in the morning carrying it back to your practice room. This way, I just walk into a studio, me, without anything else except my voice, do my work, and go. And it's so much fun. It's a real pleasure. And I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
I mean, I think a lot of people think, you know, that you just naturally have that voice. And obviously you do to a certain extent. But I mean, it's not like you haven't put some kind of effort and time and work into crafting that and absolutely bringing out the very best of your kind of range.
Sure. I mean, it also depends on the job. I mean, the thing is, people want different things. And I do documentaries, I do commercials, I do all kinds of different corporate films. And depending on what people want, the most important thing for me is to be able to speak in a calm, fluid sentences without too many breaks and pauses, and then actually adapt to what the producer or the director wants. And sometimes they ask you to do some very strange things with your voice, but one does one's best. And
what's the strangest thing someone's ever asked you to do with your voice?
The strangest thing. I mean, it's not strange. It's like, for example, I have a lot of German directors, and they'll think of the melodic sound of a certain sentence in German and ask me to do that in English, where I say, we don't do that in English, you know, to go up at the end of a question, like, where are you going today? I mean, we don't do that. So, where are you going today? Just the where, by saying where right at the beginning, indicates that you're about to ask a question. So we run into things like that where I tell them this is not natural. We don't do this in English. Sometimes they insist because they think they know better. So then I do it the way they want to. Then I get a little frustrated, but I don't, as long as they pay my check, I'm good.
I mean, you've obviously done some quite big commercials, as you say, but yeah. Have you done like Netflix, or have you done like sort of Disney films, or what else have you done?
I don't do any dubbing. That would be more dubbing stuff, but I've done, I was the claim voice for Mercedes AMG for 3 years, which means, and that worldwide all media, meaning that whatever country or whatever language they produce a video or a commercial or anything that is related to Mercedes AMG for 3 years, whatever language they produce it in, at the end comes the claim, and that was me saying AMG driving performance, and that for 3 years. And that was the shortest gig I ever had. It took 3 or 4 minutes in the studio, and it was the best paying job I've ever had. It was amazing.
Quanto es?
Well, a lot. 5 figures.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The upper 5-figure range.
Good for you.
Thank you. Thank you. But those jobs don't exist anymore. You know what I mean?
Why? What about AI, then? What do you think about this idea coming in?
AI, but companies aren't willing to pay that kind of money anymore. Back then, I remember somebody telling me that the guy who did, I think it was 5 years, the same kind of thing, the claim for Volkswagen for 5 years, all media worldwide, 5 years, was paid €1 million. To say Volkswagen, das Auto.
Stop it.
And that'll never happen again, just because the companies don't have those kind of budgets anymore, and AI has slipped into the mix. Mm. And that's going to ruin everyone's job.
Mm. The only thing I'm a little bit excited about is this idea of just like translating things, you know, like transcribing and translating a text and then voicing it over with AI.
Yeah, it's terrible. I get a lot of text documentaries that are in German. They are translated with AI. Mm. And the problem with AI right now is, for translations, it loses the sense of what's going on. If you have if let's say there's a reference to something that was written 2 or 3 sentences before, AI forgets it. It's literally translating sentence per sentence and not keeping the sense of what's happening throughout the whole paragraph or that page or pages. So, yeah, sometimes it's wrong what you're hearing, and it's bizarre, and you have to. I get these texts, and I have to correct them, and it's a 1-hour documentary, and sometimes I spend a lot of time on making the text actually make sense. It's really annoying. But companies are using it because it's cheap. They just throw it right through the translator. It's done in just a few seconds, and that's that. They don't have to pay a human being to translate the text. But then I sit there and have to correct it for an hour or two, which, anyway.
Interesting. No, well, interest me anyway, because I've spent many, many years of my life doing exactly that and trying to run it through, you know, a faster way of doing it. And then obviously, you know, having to go back and do it long form, because it is a labor of love. But I think it's worth it, frankly, to be able to kind of put things into different languages on an island like this one, because it's such an international island. But not to have certain projects also in Spanish feels like a bit of a, you know, like sacrilege, really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't have that much experience with what's happening here on the island in terms of translations or people working with languages. My work is primarily focused and centered in Germany. So I couldn't really tell you what's going on the island in that respect.
So what was it like growing up in Ibiza until you were 15?
Amazing. Out in the nature. I mean, I was born here in 1968, so you have to imagine, under the Franco regime, a dictatorship, which we had no knowledge or perception of, because we just grew up isolated here on Ibiza, and it was just a wonderful, surrounded by nature, water, and the Mediterranean, and just very carefree, and carefree and free. We were always outside. You're either at the beach or you're out in the campo, in the countryside, and very small schools, and just yeah, surrounded. You know the nature around here. It's beautiful. And very few people. I mean, we still had the Ivysenkos, the locals, that would come by with their donkeys and carts, and you get your fresh vegetables from the farmer or whatever you needed from your neighbors. And it was a wonderful little community. And the foreigners that were living here, a bunch of expatriates, expats from all over the world, but a very small community of artists and very creative people. It was amazing. I loved it.
What made you depart these fair lands at the age of 15?
Explore the world. I'd been here till I was 15, and although you're surrounded by all this, you know, all these things that I've just described that made it so wonderful, at the same time, as a 15-year-old, you want to leave. You want to see what else there is. And my father was living in Mexico at the time, and I said to my mom, I want to go live with my dad. She said, all right. I finished school here, did my 5 O levels at the British school that I was at, and it was time to go. There weren't any more schools here that would have been worthwhile attending, so I went to Mexico to live with my dad, and from there started exploring the world.
What was your dad up to in Mexico that made you want to go and join him?
Well, he was a writer, and he lived in Mexico because it was cheap and beautiful. This was in the 1980s when I went there, and kind of like an Ibiza atmosphere in Mexico, if you can believe it or not, in a small town with expats and artists. And I had visited before. He had been there for some years, and I just wanted to live with my dad as well. It didn't matter where he was, but Mexico just happened to be the place where he was, and that was an amazing experience as well. I finished my last 2 years of high school there in a bilingual school. And I was really tall, and everybody looked up to me. And I arrived when I was 15. Everybody thought I was in my 20s. I was like, yeah.
How did that pan out for you? Did it land you a few hot dates at 15?
No, I was very shy, actually, as a 15-year-old. But it kind of, I was able to get into all the bars and drink, and I started smoking. It's not a good thing. Anyway, everyone smoked there. It was either you smoked or you just weren't cool. So I wanted to be cool, so I smoked. But I stopped 3 months ago. Yeah.
I think your voice has been helped by the smoking, though.
I don't think so. My voice hasn't changed since I stopped smoking. So,
the texture of it, I think, like, you know, some people that smoke, I'm not like endorsing smoking, just to be clear, but I'm saying that there is definitely a type of voice that smokers have.
It does add a bit of a raw touch to it. That's why people always say, yeah, keep smoking, have a drink of whiskey, you know, and keep that voice the way it is.
So what did you get up to with your dad in Mexico when you first arrived as a young teen?
Well, my dad gave me a certain sense of freedom. He taught me how to drive. He gave me the keys to the car. He gave me the keys to the house. And he said, do whatever you want. Be responsible. Don't get into trouble. And if you do, then it's your responsibility. And I said, wow, that sounds so great.
What a guy.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dad. Are you trying to get rid of me or what? No.
What happened?
No, I spent a lot of time with my friends. I went to school in a town that was about a 45-minute drive away in another city called Querétaro. And I was able to take the car whenever I wanted. I was allowed to go out during the week, during school nights, as long as I just, you know, made sure I didn't, like my dad said, don't get into trouble and be responsible. And I was responsible. Did get into trouble a couple times, but that's a different story.
I think that sounds like your dad was a bit of a legend by the sounds of it anyway. I mean, obviously he's, you know, a carefree and footloose man and kind of living life on his own terms.
Yeah. My father was also an only child, but also a very creative man, a writer and an adventurer. And he never really let anything hold him back from his adventures and what he wanted to do and accomplish in life, which I admire. It also requires some kind of sacrifice with family sometimes. But, I admired him for who he was and how he went about his life. I do things slightly differently. I also have a son, and I'm closer to him than my father and I. We were close when I was younger, but my father also lived a lifestyle that was more centered around himself, which is okay. Everyone's entitled to live how they want, but, so he was an idol of mine for quite some time, but then my life took a different turn.
Which was,
when, first of all, when my son was born, my father, for example, after the whole, when my parents divorced, my father left Ibiza and went to go live in Mexico in the United States. And, I, for example, my, with my son, his mother and I also separated, but I never would have left where my son was. I wanted to be around my son and be there to be his father while he was growing up. That was for me, that was very important. My father kind of neglected his duties as a father in that respect, which is okay. It's, you know, everyone makes their choices, and I wish he would have been around more, but that's the way it was. And but I chose to do it differently with my son.
What effect did that have on you, your dad leaving Ibiza?
Well, I was with my mom. I spent most of the time with our mother growing up with our mom. The effect that it has, that I wanted to go live with my dad, that I wanted to see him more, and we did visit him every summer. But at the same time, I felt freer around my father because he just gave me more liberties to do whatever I wanted. So, and I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed that trust. I didn't abuse it. So as a teenager, that's when I really started to push my mom and say, I want to go live with my dad. And then when I was 15, then she said, okay, you can go. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have been really... She couldn't have stopped me, actually, at some point. Because I would have just gone.
Layers.
Yeah.
Can you give us a Mexican accent?
Órale. Sí, así hablan los mexicanos. Yeah. Now, there's a... what I really loved about Mexico is the Spanish that they speak, the accents, or actually across all of South America, are completely different than from Spain. The Spanish speak with a lisp. cinco zapatos. Oy, hostia, tío. ¿Por qué no te pones tus zapatos?
Is that shoes?
Mexicans, yeah, why don't you put on your shoes? I said, I don't know why, I'm just like coming up with this stuff. But the Mexicans are like, órale, güey, ¿por qué no vamos a salvar a chupar unas chelas, mano? There's a whole different melody to it. It's beautiful. I love the way they speak. I probably didn't, I'm faking it, but, you know, it's something like that.
They always say don't learn Spanish in South America, though, that's completely different, and I don't know.
Yeah, and you can run into some very precarious situations where a certain word here means something completely different over there.
Like what?
Like,
give it to us. Go on, say it.
Okay, here, coger is, you know, voy a coger el autobús. I'm going to go get the bus. Coger in Mexico means to fuck. Which means, you know, I'm going to go fuck the bus. So things get turned around slightly, yeah, things like that. So
righty-ho, yes, one must be very cautious.
Yes, and they'll
about the bus.
Oh, they'll let you know very quickly that you've just said something pretty silly. Yeah, look at the exhaust on that bus. Mm.
It's got a big engine.
Big engine. Look at that exhaust. Smoky.
Smoking hot.
Smoking hot.
So when was it that you obviously came back to the island? I know you haven't moved back here full time, but you've had some adventures in between, and obviously you have another house in Germany.
Well, I always came back to visit my mom, usually once or twice a year, Christmas and summer, and also took my son here a lot. And then my son is now, he's going to be 29 in July, so he's all independent and on his own, which is wonderful. And in the last 3 years, I just started coming back to Ibiza more often, and started to feel at home again. I always felt at home, but wanted to stay longer. I've been in Berlin, in Germany, for the past 32 years, and I'm just really tired of the city life and Germany and mainland Europe. And I just want to, I'm drawn back to the island now. I want to come back and live here most of the year. I wouldn't mind 2 or 3 months somewhere else. Maybe not Germany in the future, maybe somewhere else, but at least spend 7, 8, 9 months out of the year here on the island. I have a lot of friends still from my childhood, and it feels home. Every time I take a breath and I smell the countryside and the pine trees and the salt in the air from the... it's just... I know I'm home. And it's still a beautiful island. It's very overrun now. There's a lot of people, but... here in this area where I live in the north, it's still a lot of very open, free countryside that just makes it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, that inspires you creatively to produce this collection that we're kind of overlooking right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the motion of the Mediterranean has always fascinated me. I think the waters here around Ibiza, I've been to the Caribbean, and I think the water here is more beautiful than in the Caribbean. Clearer, more crystal, has a crystal effect to it. The turquoise color of it, and under the right conditions and the motions of imagery under the water and on the surface of the water, this very organic motion that sometimes creates web-like patterns or colors that you can only catch. And if you're really, you have to really look at what's going on. And if you see these things and capture them and stop time, because water is in constant motion, you have to stop time to really get certain images to come out. And that's what I do. I'm sometimes baffled and blown away at what I'm looking at later when I go home and start looking at the images on my computer. I have an idea already while I'm doing it, but afterwards it's just like, wow, look at that. Yeah, water just does amazing things, and with the motion, it's a constant changing motion. If there are objects under the on the seabed, the water passes between them, over them, under them, and it's moving in different frequencies and velocities, and swirls happen in ways that you can't even imagine, like you can see in this thing here. All this complex motion of the water. And you can only capture that with a camera, because just looking at it is like more like watching a film. And I like to stop time and see what's there.
I mean, I thought that they were actually paintings when I first walked in, so I was quite glad that you established the fact that these are actually photographs, obviously blown up and immensely enlarged and zoomed in. And they're actually quite trippy if you stand and stare at them for far too long. I'm feeling quite spun out, actually, if I'm really honest.
You're feeling dizzy, Jo?
Just a little bit.
A little bit, yes.
Which so where's this one taken? Sorry, the biggest blue, incredible, massive, enormous photograph. Kalalinya. As you walk in on the back wall.
Kalalinya, just about 10 minutes from here, north from here, no, 10, 15 minutes. Near Kalanova. Yeah. These are all different beaches. Sometimes I'm walking around the north part of the island between Kalabasa and Kalakomte on the cliffs, and you can just see amazing things happening from above when you're looking down at the water. And sometimes I go out and I take pictures for hours and I go home and there's nothing there worth keeping. It's the whole process of it. And you think you see something that, wow, look at that. And then you stop it and it's not quite what I imagined. And then sometimes it's even better than what I imagined.
I mean, they're spectacular. I mean, I just didn't, you know, obviously this entire collection is called Under the Surface, but I quite like to rename it Motion of the Ocean.
Okay, Motion of the Ocean. Ocean in motion. Ocean motion.
It is, though. It's spectacular what you've managed to grasp there. It's like there's so many different directions on that water. There's obviously a lot of wind involved, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, actually here there's less wind. It's the motion of actually
the ocean.
The motion of the ocean on its way to the beach. The water is very wavy, even when it doesn't look like it is. And on the crests of these tiny little waves, the water captures the sun. The sun is focused onto these little crests and then projected down onto the seabed. And that's what you're looking at there, what we call light ripples, or actually, they're actually called caustic networks.
Of course they are.
Yes.
What's a caustic network exactly?
A light ripple, that what I just described. Yeah. It's easier to say light ripples, but I just thought I'd try to sound a little intellectual and call them caustic networks. Anyway, but they're like these web-like patterns that you see at the bottom of the, or on the seabed when you're standing on the beach and you're looking at the sun being projected onto the sand underneath the water. And that's what that is. And sometimes they can be extremely complex, depending on how the water is moving or the angle of the sun, if there's wind on the surface, and it all of the elements play a role. Yeah.
And that one's already sold, apparently.
Well, could be. Not yet. Would be nice if it did sell.
No, I thought that one was gone.
I don't know what to do with it afterwards, because I brought it down from Germany. And we're in
It's very large.
Spain. It's very large. Yeah, it's 2 meters 10 by 1 meter 40, which is about 7 feet by 4.5 feet.
How did you get that here from Germany?
On a truck.
Wow.
Yeah, all six of these. Mm. It's a transport, this guy that just, he drives around all of Germany picking up things that people want to bring to the island, and he charges by the cubic meter. And that was good, because hiring a private art transport company would have cost a fortune. Mm. Anyway, so I got them down here, and now they're hanging. One's been sold, and I'm hoping to sell a couple more. And if not, Yeah, I'll take them to the hippie market.
I mean, you know, when in doubt,
sell them to some hippies.
Exactly.
Some rich hippies.
Well,
you know. Hippies on the island now seem to have changed. You know, in the 60s, it was a different kind of hippie.
Well, the hippie market is possibly one of the most expensive places on Ibiza to go shopping.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But we love it. It's a beautiful spot. And it's, yeah, it should be celebrated, I think, as one of.
It's fun to be at. And it's a great meeting place as well to meet people.
It is. Is that on, that's Wednesdays in Escanar.
Yeah. Well, there's also the Las Dalias one. They call it a hippie market, but you know.
Hippie-ish. Hippie-ish.
Hippie-ish market. Exactly.
So let's get on to, you know, the next one in the series, because we've been to Kelalinya, and now we're coming to my favourite beach, actually, which is where one of my favourite restaurants is, El Bigotes, where we recorded an episode of this podcast once upon a time. And this one is Kalamastea, and it almost looks like you've got, like, coral in this picture. It's incredible.
It's bizarre, isn't it? And what you see, that what you think is coral, is it's just rock. It's like these yellowish, reddish rocks that are under the water, and this is the water moving around and above the rocks. Yeah, and it's, as you can see, it's very colorful, but those colors don't exist like that when you're looking at the water itself or at the seabed at Kalamastea. The structure, though, and the colors that you see are there, I just enhance them quite a bit just to give it a more of a painterly kind of touch to it.
It's just insane, actually. That's actually my favorite for sure in terms of the swirliness of it and the colors and the kind of, you know, the repetition, I think, of the kind of echo of that wave.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I like it too. Also the different motion. It's calmer than, say, the one with the light ripples and the caustic networks. It's just a different kind of motion that's happening. And here you can see that the water is moving. There's more motion of the water here. Here it's so more softer. There's more. The motion starts again there and here and here. So that's a perfect example of the water just adapting to the environment that it's moving in, meaning the around the rocks and speeding up and slowing down and moving in different directions as it approaches everything that's underneath the water, the surface.
So I'm imagining you with your sort of, you know, trousers or your pants in America. There was your pants rolled up around your knees, waddling in the water, capturing these. I mean, talk us through how this process actually occurred.
Well, I'm not in the water for this one. This is, like you mentioned, El Bigote. You know, there's like a little dock there. I'm on the dock, standing on there, looking through the water at the seabed. And that was taken there. For the other ones here, like, for example, this one, the one that was taken in Salinas on the sandbank, those two, the one that you like also very much over there. There I'm standing on the water, in the water. In the.
How long do you have to stand in the water to try and capture these images?
You can be really lucky and just stand there and suddenly as if God said, well, let's give this guy something to take a picture of. And then, wow, look at that. That was amazing.
I mean, you stand in there all day?
Well, a couple of hours, sure. Camera gets really heavy after a while. Starts to hurt my neck, and I have to take a break.
And you're looking down the whole time with your sore neck that you had a slipped disc in.
Doing that, exactly. And I'm waiting, and one eye is looking over there, and the other one's looking right through the lens. So, yeah, it can be a bit strenuous. So I take breaks, and then it's happened so often where I take a break, I'm holding the camera, and there comes that perfect wave, and oh, shit. After about an hour, I'm waiting. God damn it.
Missed it again.
Missed it. God, you know.
That's annoying. Mother Nature, she's
really
just
annoying. She's like,
very inconvenient sometimes.
You waited. Look at what I just did. I'm here to piss you off.
I mean, she does that sometimes, but that's why we love her, because you just never know what's coming.
I want to insult her, but then I go, no. No, there's no point. There's no reason. So I know I work with Mother Nature, and I do get rewarded for patience.
Patience pays off is one of my favorite phrases, actually. Patience and persistence.
Absolutely. Patience, persistence, passion, the passion to keep doing it, and the drive. And it's just, and in the end, it's not really work. It's really that passion and that persistence and wanting to capture something unique and unusual. and to be able to show the world, look, Mother Nature does this as well. Because this is all, obviously, Mother Nature is producing these pictures. I'm just there taking a snapshot of it.
Well, as you say, you know, literally as we speak, I don't know how many billions of waves are crashing onto the sand around the world as we actually have this conversation.
Right. And not only that, each one of these pictures will never be able to be reproduced again. They're like snowflakes. Each one is an original. It's not like a architecture where you're under the right conditions and you keep coming back. You can take the same shot over and over and over and over again. This is a split second in time that you'll never be able to reproduce again.
I did study, actually, the history of photography when I was at college, and there was a photographer called Henri Cartier-Bresson, who I was quite fascinated with about his decisive moment, which I believe he produced a book about. And it was just like, yeah, I mean, for you to have caught that tiny little nanosecond in time to have created these images is really quite special. And how do you know, you know, good Lord, we've got an alien behind us in the gallery.
He's continuing. Oh, my God. Joe, I'm afraid.
I'm scared. Let's go.
Wavy alien.
The decisive moment. That's where we were.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes you just know. I mean, there's like with the reflections that I was showing you before, the reflections on the surface of water, you just see somebody. That's where I'm using. These are all handheld. They're all taken with the camera being handheld. But if I'm using a tripod, and I have like just one spot that I'm just waiting for something to happen, like people to walk by and catch them on the surface of the water, on the reflection. If I know the sun is right and the motion on the water, I see it already. And once I've taken the shot, I know that is going to be a good shot. Mm-hmm. It's that moment you go, ooh, can't wait to get home, take a look at it. That kind of thing. So it's a very decisive thing. But with these, sometimes there is a certain randomness to it, though, because sometimes there's so much motion, I can't quite see exactly what's going on all the time. So I might take like a series of shots, 10, 12, 15, within just a few seconds. And then something amazing does actually come out of that. That's more of a slightly random process that can also work really well.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just they're really beautiful. There was a photographer that we studied at college, and he'd had a series of pictures of clouds. You know, he'd had a lot of series and series and series of clouds, and it was just like they were just absolutely insanely beautiful.
Yeah, exactly, and it's probably, you know, the same thing as water, and they're in motion. They're not moving as fast, obviously, as water, but it's also one of those things. It's just a moment in time that you'll never be able to reproduce again, because that cloud's not going to do that for you a second time.
Well, no, I think cloud formations are, you know, they're water too, aren't they? They're just, you know, completely and utterly astounding at times what goes on up there, but also down there, which is obviously what you've been doing. Right. I mean, how long, you know, I like the series of pictures that you were showing me that are reflections that you took for your book, which one of which is actually being displayed in Tokyo, I do believe, as we speak.
It's actually not a reflection. It's a refraction, which is the distorted, an object underwater that is being distorted. It's a refracted image. Through light being refracted or bent by the water, causing whatever image you're taking a picture of also to be distorted and bent because of the light being bent by the water. And that was a picture of a carp that I took. Actually, I was there at this pond for 3 days waiting for this carp to swim in front of my camera because I saw the potential of the shot. And on the third day, I was going to jump in the water and harpoon it and thought, kill it and just like wave it in front of under the water and take its picture. God damn you. But no, it actually swam in front of the camera. The light conditions were perfect. The water motion was perfect. There was a little bit of wind that moved the surface of the water. Bam, took the shot. And that was it. I knew I had it. And then that shot was, I sent it to Tokyo, to the Tokyo International Photo Awards, and won third prize in the fine art photography category. Which is terrific, and now they're going to display it on screen at a gallery in Tokyo for 4 days at the end of this month.
Amazing. That's very cool indeed. Were you not tempted just to get a little worm on the end of your on your rod and just dangle it and tempt that little puppy?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Did you?
No.
Would that have been cheating?
I wanted it. Yeah, it would have been cheating.
Stop it. You didn't get any bait out for it.
No.
Why?
No. Why? Well, actually, the carps at this pond are used to people feeding them, so some they do actually follow people around. Except, again, Mother Nature wanted to make it difficult for me because I had my camera with me, so the carp was avoiding me for some reason. I don't know.
He's just a bit camera shy.
It was camera shy. I think it knew that I was wanting to take a picture of it.
And you were standing in the water this time or
no,
on the dock?
I'm on the edge of the pond, man-made pond in the middle of the city. Crazy.
So do you prefer life on the surface or under the surface?
Both. Really, both. On the surface is usually just a reflection of what's outside of the water or around the water, so that it's reflecting on its surface. It could be the sky, clouds, a building, people. Under the surface is then what is actually, you know, living or under the water. Either in a man-made situation, obviously, it's going to be mostly rock or concrete, but which can be pretty interesting once life begins to grow on it. But in the ocean, obviously, like in the Mediterranean, there's all kinds of amazing things on the sea floor, rocks, plant life, fish, and that can create some wonderful imagery.
What would you say your favorite image that you've produced would be?
Ooh, that's a tough one. You were looking of the reflective stuff. The reflections, there's one that you were looking at, Red Sneakers. That's one of my favorite ones, definitely.
I really want to buy that.
People walking along a boardwalk on a lake, which I really, really enjoyed taking that picture. And I love the composition. I never get bored of it.
Mm. That on a big white wall in a big old finca. I mean, it would look pretty epic on my wall in my house, actually. I'm seriously considering it.
Say, Joe.
I want your painting. Yeah, it's a photograph. It's not a painting.
Exactly. They're photographs. And those also look very much like paintings, the ones of the people, the reflections. But that's just the nature of water, because water is liquid. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at imagery on a moving liquid, which paint is a liquid. We use, what comes out of a tube that you paint with is a very thick kind of liquid. You water it down with water or oil or whatever, turpentine, depending on what you're using. So in a way, water and what's happening on the surface or underneath water, the motion of that gives it that painterly kind of feeling to it. Mm. It's just the nature of water in motion.
Motion of the ocean.
Yeah, the motion of the ocean. There we are, back at the beginning.
So what has the reaction been to the motion of the ocean? What did Pepe Roseo, the former owner of Space, think about it? Because he was here for your launch.
Yeah, he loved it. He was amazed. He said he'd never seen anything like it. And that's a lot of people's reaction is that. It's like, what? Wait a minute. These are photographs? And I say, yeah. And people don't expect what they're coming to see. And they are quite unique. And I'm not saying that to be arrogant or because I'm big-headed or whatever. I never really had considered showing my work. I've been doing this for 25 years or longer. Mm. And by chance, at the bar Anitas, which is a portal to the world, as you know, a very international crowd there, I met an art curator from Berlin, who knew the work of my parents and some of the other artists, famous artists that had lived here on the island. And we got to talking, and I mentioned that I do photography, and he said he very much wanted to see what I do. And he took a look, and he said, "This is, you've got to show your stuff." He said, "It's so unique." He said, it's not only good. He said, it's unique. It's different. It's photography in a way that I've never seen it. And he said, "I've been curating art for over 30 years. So I decided to start to show my work, share it."
Beautiful. I think, well, you know, these deserve a lot more, exhibit in some very big, lovely people's homes. And I think there's one more week of this exhibition to go after this podcast is published this week on Friday. So people have got the weekend to pop in here to the gallery, which is in the middle of Santa Laria. It's actually tucked away next to a wonderful ice cream shop, actually. So you could get yourself a little ice cream and get all high on sugar and then come in here and dive into your waves.
It's like touching everything with your sticky, sugary, ice creamy hands.
Well, they might wash them first. They're quite civilized, these people that listen to my podcast. How dare you, Ned?
Oh, you never know.
Insulting the good people.
People get high on ice cream, you know. It's like I get this little sugar high, and it's like, oh, look at that. Look at the mushroom. Don't start. It's amazing how many people actually do want to touch the pictures.
I thought about it.
Yeah. There's 3 millimeters of plexiglass on there. That's why I think people feel like they want to. It's almost as if it gives it a bit of a watery effect, actually.
In terms of galleries in Ibiza, though, I mean, we don't see. I mean, there are, you know, a few around, but I think Santalaria was like crying out for a new gallery space to bring all these like interesting works.
Yeah.
You know, to have a place where and a platform where people can kind of access them, mm-hmm. and actually discover new artists, because obviously, as you pointed out, your journey and being here when you were growing up, and the thing that attracted you to go and hang out with your dad is like these creative places and spaces that you know, ripe for the taking, really, in terms of like the kinds of people that are drawn to Ibiza are the kinds of people that should have more, I think, of a voice and certainly be more visible.
Yeah, and I'm really grateful actually to Olas Gallery and Sofia and Luca for, I mean, I think they've been open now just slightly over a year, April of last year, and they feature only artists from the island and good artists, and we realize, you know, that there's a lot of talent here, and that's their thing, and I think we can all be very grateful, not only the artists but the people who live here, that there is a place like Olas Gallery that is presenting these artists, and Sofia herself is also a photographer and does lovely work, so we're all very grateful and thankful for Olas Gallery and Sofia and Luca and the work that they do here.
I think, well, Sofia has been a guest on this podcast. If anyone wants to search Sofia Gomez, she is there in the 224 people now it's been. It's just, she's there somewhere, so you'll have to have a little listen back to that. But she hadn't got the gallery at the time that we recorded it, actually, so we never talked about this project. But I think, you know, she's put a lot of time and effort into creating this space, and we're all very grateful for it. I mean, she had some unbelievable opening just over a year ago, as you said, and it was like literally you couldn't move. There was like about 500 people outside this room, and there was a lot of beautiful drinks and snacks, and you know, she really laid on a good spread, as we say in England.
That was the first, the very first opening of the gallery. Fantastic. Wow, congratulations.
And then there's one other gallery, nothing like this one. It's complete. It's like buried in the middle of nowhere. I'm trying to remember. It's got a very strange name. Can you imagine what that gallery might be? It's like a man who, I think he's no longer with us. Can't remember the name of that place. It's a really special, very enormous, cavernous, white, enormous gallery.
Sounds like you can't miss it.
Well, you would, because if you didn't know it was there, you would never discover it.
Oh, right. Cavernous, meaning what? It's underground? It's cave-like? Or
it's like a rabbit warren. It's just got loads of little different kind of alleys that go on to different rooms.
Where is it? Do you know
I can't even remember the name of it. I'm gonna come up with it later. It'll come to me, and I will WhatsApp it to you.
Let me know. Yeah, I'd like to go see that.
It is very, very, very cool. And I like the fact that she's also got, you know, lots of books for people to kind of read some of the works,
absolutely,
as you said, of the artists on the island. And, you know, you could just swing by here, really, and have a coffee.
Some of these, I think, she's also exhibited. There's a few here. Yes, she has all kinds of things to look at. Some of her own work as well. And I think that the books here are of artists that she has also exhibited.
Yeah, no, there's no shortage of good books and good artists in Ibiza. We're very, very lucky for that. Thank you so much for joining me here. And it's been a joy to discover your artistry and your creativity and your big instrument that is your voice as well. I could listen to it all day and probably just do a whole podcast on that, to be fair, if I was allowed.
Here, Ned, read this.
Do you do audiobooks?
No.
Meditations?
Not yet.
No, I can just imagine, nodding off to that if you were going to create like a little sleep series. I reckon it could work.
I'd probably listen to it myself.
The Cadbury's Sleep Series, sponsored by the chocolate, Mr. Willy Wonka.
There you go. Sleep now, everybody. Sleep in sweet dreams.
Yeah. Have you had any weird requests for things like that?
No, not yet.
Okay.
No.
Just me.
One guy wanted me to do his answering machine, which I did. Turned it into a threat. This is the answering machine of Michael Fisher. If you don't get back to me, you know, one of those kind of things.
Not, hey, how you doing? Yeah. Sorry, you can't get through.
Yeah, just doing one of those threatening Hollywood trailer voices, like, you know, in a world, that kind of thing. Yeah, so that was fun. No, but thank you so much, Joe, for having me on your podcast. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, keep doing it. It's fun. Nice to talk to you. And it's nice that you're doing this also for the people on the island and artists and whoever else you may be interviewing. I think it's a good thing as well. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And yes, I believe there's one more week remaining of Under the Surface. So if you are passing through Santa Ilaria and want to get high on sugar and then pop in, I think that's a great plan. There's also, there's a lot of like good little pockets of lovely things around here that you can spend a whole afternoon digging away. And we will see you on Monday for our next episode in our trilogy of interviews for the Ray of Light Awards. And I'm going to have a very special guest. So definitely check back here on Monday.
Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back.